My people, hello. It's your girl E, and this is The Call, where we talk to wildly inspiring and interesting women about their journey to answer their life's calling. So before we jump into this week's episode, which is so, so good, I want to give a shout out to this episode's sponsors over at Juice Beauty. Fun fact about me, I actually paid my way through school working in a spa as an esthetician, a licensed skincare professional. That means when I wasn't in class, I was giving people facials and waxing and doing makeup applications. Now, clearly, that didn't end up being my life's calling, but ever since then, I've been obsessed with healthy and clean ingredients that feed my skin, and I don't believe that women should have to choose between beauty and health. Neither does Juice Beauty's founder, Karen Behnke. Juice Beauty offers high-performance skincare and vibrant makeup made with antioxidant-rich certified organic ingredients, and that's a big part of their mission, sourcing from USA Organic Farms. So, for your skincare or makeup needs, you should check them out by signing up for emails on juicebeauty.com/thecall. And you can enjoy a special offer with your first order. Okay? Okay, now on to the show. Unless you've been hiding under a rock somewhere, you know that we're living in the era of resistance, where every day there's a new opportunity to either quietly lay down and let hatred and injustice eat us alive, or we have the option to stand up and fight. Most of the people I know have chosen to fight in one way or another. I know I have. I've participated in protests, I've signed petitions, I've boycotted, and yes, I've unfriended high school classmates on Facebook. But sometimes I wonder, even with my radical politics and my undying commitment to justice, how far am I really willing to go? For those of us who choose to fight, how comfortable are we with this comfort, with taking risks, with being controversial? Well, this week's guest, Ashley Marie Preston, is very comfortable with all of that. As a Black trans woman, she's been disrupting her whole life just by virtue of who she is. She was the first trans woman to head up a major publication, Wear Your Voice magazine. And as a writer, media advocate, and activist, much of her adult life has been spent fighting for marginalized communities of all kinds. Her name has been in the news a lot lately, precisely because she's not afraid of confrontation in the name of truth.
We continue to be the ones that are most impacted by the choices that you make. It is not okay. It is not okay. It is not okay.
You don't know me?
Yes, I do. The whole...
Yep. That was her confronting Caitlyn Jenner. TMZ loved that one.
The trans community is boycotting The Breakfast Club because your music and your ideology reinforces transphobia that kills us. We are not a joke.
Trans people are not a joke. Trans people are not a joke.
And that was her confronting popular radio morning show host and author Charlamagne Tha God after transphobic remarks were made on his show. Since both of those incidents, she's had more light shone on all of her activism, and she's become this larger-than-life leader with a capital L. But when I met her, I wanted to know her actual story, not just her politics. How does someone become that bold and that fearless? Well, in our conversation, she answers that and so much more. This woman is as transparent as they come. We talk about what happens when life gets hard while pursuing your call.
For the first time, my dreams were halted.
What does it really mean to be an ally?
Everybody's an ally until it's time to align with the objectives and mission of the most marginalized among us. Allyship is the new chihuahua in a handbag.
And how does she measure her own success as a freedom fighter?
This isn't a race. And there's no finish line. There's no graduation. There's no ceremony. We're talking about spiritual warfare.
I'm telling y'all, she drops so many gems. So sit back, be inspired, and learn a thing or two from the fierce and principled Ashley Marie Preston here on The Call. Ashley Marie, thank you for being on The Call.
Of course, of course, of course.
I'm so thrilled to talk to you. I'm actually thrilled to catch you because you've been quite the busy bee lately.
Oh, that is, I can't even begin to describe it.
You've been all over the place. Now, I know your work as an activist and advocate and writer and media creator extends far back beyond this year. But this was the year I saw you on TMZ, okay?
Yes.
So there's been a lot. You've kind of recently burst onto the mainstream, at least the radar of kind of national media.
Yes.
Because of your protests, right? Because you've been protesting very high-profile figures, among others, right? But Caitlyn Jenner and Charlamagne Tha God. What has life been like since then, right? We've seen these big moments of you using your voice and speaking truth to power. What happens afterwards?
What happens afterwards is that other people come to you with causes and things that they want to see change. And so essentially you become this, I guess, of course, leader, but people have so much faith in you that they want you to kind of take on some of their objectives and their agenda. And so while that's flattering and it really touches my heart, I'm only one person.
Yeah, so you can't do everything.
No, but I try.
Yeah. How does one get to that point? How do you develop the boldness to be able to kind of speak out in these big public ways?
I think it's because I am a Black trans woman. And activism was never something that was optional. You know, there's so many intersections to my identity, whether it be being a plus-size woman, whether it be being Black or being trans. And so I feel as though because African-American trans women are among the highest marginalized in America, and because we continue to lose our lives due to senseless violence and transphobia and all of these other things, like, I have no choice but to speak up, especially for those who don't have the capacity to speak up for themselves.
So because of your identities, intersecting identities, right, you felt like activism was never really a choice or an option for you. But when did you start? Were you always aware of that?
It started in elementary school when...
So you're serious. Always.
The teacher... Always. It used to get me in trouble. I would always be sent to the principal's office. I would have a referral. I would go home and get my butt tore up. Like, just all kinds of things. And I just always had this visceral response to challenge injustice in any form that it came in. So I feel like most activists and people that are passionate about activism, they typically have like a, I don't want to say one trick pony, but they definitely have a niche, like something that they really put all their energy into. I tackle all injustices. Like, there's nothing. So I will speak up for women's reproductive rights. I will speak up for trans women. I will speak up for people with disabilities. I'm against any kind of Muslim ban, you know, anything that's going on that's going to be divisive and separate us from one another and create negative experiences for anyone, I'm here for it. I'm here to snatch wigs.
Wigs need to be snatched right
snatched,
now.
Peeled all the way back. Peeled all the way back.
So when you did that as a kid, when you kind of recognized that instinct in yourself to always push back against injustice anywhere you saw it, what was the pushback against you?
I think at the time, people didn't really know how to take me, especially in Kentucky. So,
right, you grew up in Kentucky.
Yeah, so I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. And most people, I call it the smile of a thousand knives because people aren't as vocal.
Yeah.
So in the South, you learn how to be, you know, hospitable and kind of like, you know, kind
heart.
And like, you know, yeah. Bless your heart. Bless your abominable out of God's word, you know, like. And so for me, it was like, nope, I see this for what it is. And so after doing that for 19 years, I decided, you know what? I'm going to leave Kentucky. I'm going to find out what my purpose and my passion is in the world. I'm good at so many things, but I feel like there's just so much of the world to see, and I want a more authentic experience. So I came out to California, and there was definitely a lot to be understood and learned about those experiences and how my journey started.
And so you came out here with that express purpose, that intent of saying, like, I want to figure out what I'm called to do in the world and how to use who I am and my gifts and my talents.
Exactly. I wasn't willing to believe that there was nobody else like me. We didn't have a word for transgenderism in Kentucky, so there was no language to express how I identified and how I just felt just different, you know. But I knew that somewhere in the world there were people like me.
And how did you know that? Most people don't have, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of folks feel that sense of isolation, that sense of loneliness or otherness, and just kind of assume that that's the way the rest of the world is. And you just had this instinct that said, nah, I'm not alone.
I knew I wasn't because there were a lot of other things that would happen, even in Kentucky, where I would see how people would live 2 and 3 and 4 different lives. You know what I mean? Like, especially in the church, like you're saying all these things, but then I see you kind of like getting close to the piano director, you know, and right. you're like a deacon and, you know, all of these little things that would go on. So yeah. I like to sit back and watch. So although I'm really vocal now, I spent the beginning part of my life really just making observations and observing people and just kind of drawing my own conclusions. And what I did know was that many of us were following this system of respectability politics. And the unfortunate part about respectability politics, and I understood this at such a young age, was that they stand as a barrier to our happiness because we're living for other people and we're not honoring ourselves by living in our truth and our complete authenticity.
You wrote a piece where you talk, it was like a letter to your younger self.
Yes.
And one of my favorite quotes from that letter was, "I give you full permission to reject the social construct of reality, as it's the number one destroyer of imagination, inspiration, and hope. Reality is what you make it." Tell me more about that.
Absolutely. One of the things that some of my greatest icons and role models and people that I've looked at throughout history and drew inspiration from, I've learned that these people thought outside of the box. And they saw things differently. Like, it took an African-American person saying, what would it be like if we didn't have to use a different water fountain? What would it feel like if we didn't have to go through the back door of our favorite restaurant? Or what would it be like if I didn't have to get up and give up my seat or go sit at the back of the bus? Or, you know, and so every single icon, the Rosa Parks, the Martin Luther Kings, the Malcolm X's, the Marsha P. Johnsons, the Sylvia Rivera's, all of these amazing, powerful individuals, they had to think outside of a framework that was already set up for them. Mm-hmm. And so growing up and even coming into my own activism, I'm keenly aware that unless we're able to challenge those thoughts and think outside of the box and imagine having a life or a narrative beyond our wildest dreams, we can never really achieve change. Mm-hmm. We have to think outside the box. And so at that time, I remember just thinking, like, one day I'm going to leave Kentucky yeah. and I'm going to build this life and I'm going to have these amazing friends who get me and understand me, and I'm going to be able to travel. I'm going to do whatever I want to do, say what I want to do, because I am different and different is okay.
Yeah, and it's amazing that you had that thought as a child, because when you were talking about the icons mm-hmm. and all of these icons that thought outside the box and had imagination, the other thought I had was, you know who else does that so well? Children, mm-hmm. right? Before it is taught out of them or educated out of them or sometimes punished out of them, children are asking why. Why does it have to be this way? Mm-hmm. Why can't I do what I want and be who I want? So it sounds like you didn't lose that, right?
Yeah. No.
So let's fast forward. You're 19. You move out to L.A. And you said there were a lot of lessons you had to learn. Was there a point on your journey once you got here that threatened that sense of hope and imagination?
Most definitely. I thought that once I figured out why I was different and I found the solution, which was my transition and trying to navigate for resources, I thought that it would be fine. And then I started facing discrimination at work. Mm-hmm. And then eventually it wasn't safe to work in the workplace. I lost my job. I wasn't able to pay rent. I ended up homeless. I had to engage in survival sex work. In order to do that, I obviously like went on drugs because I needed them to be kind of like that social lubricant to help me experience everything that I had to in the name of survival. Mm-hmm. So I felt held back and I felt powerless and I felt hopeless, because like I remember being that kid in D.A.R.E. For those of us who remember what D.A.R.E.
yep,
is.
Yep.
And I remember thinking, like, how did I get like this? I wasn't raised like this. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so much more than this. Mm-hmm. And feeling like I no longer had the keys to my own destiny any longer. And I had them being dangled over my head by society and systems of oppression. And for the first time, my dreams were halted. Mm. And there came a point when I realized there's still something in there.
In you?
In me. Mm-hmm. There's still something you have to do. There's still worth. There's still strength. There's still fire. There's still courage because your other friends are dead. And the ones who aren't dead are in prison. And the ones who aren't in prison are walking around Santa Monica Boulevard talking to themselves, the same clothes on for a month and a half. And they're alive, but they're gone. They're no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be a Black trans woman that doesn't have a criminal record, that came out of sex work unscathed, and I'm HIV negative, and I've never even had like an STD, or some of the, you know, looking at some of the actual statistics, you
right.
know, some of the disparities and challenges and added barriers that people with my lived experience come across. And so I felt as though there was this greater force, God, mm-hmm. the universe, all things that are good, that had a bigger plan for me.
Yeah.
And I needed to go through what I went through because, to be honest, I had my own preconceived notions of who people were and what types of people use drugs and what types of people open their bodies up to currency and put an actual price tag on their worth.
And then you became that person.
Exactly.
Right, right.
Exactly.
It reminds me of, my mother always says, you know, there but for the grace of God go I.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other phrase I'm thinking of is, there's got to be a reason for me to still be here, alive, surviving, clothed in my right mind.
Mm-hmm.
So then what am I to do? Like,
exactly.
what am I here for? So you recognize that. And I think that's an important part of the story, too, because so often when we talk about finding ourselves and living our best life or pursuing our call, we tell the first part, and then you see, publicly, we see the last part, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even the idea of, oh, then you got out of Kentucky and you came to L.A. and every, and it's like, nah, there was some
hardship. Beverly Hillbillies theme song in the background.
Right, right, right. But the truth is that that's where you ended up, you know, confronting a lot of what you needed to confront to become who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this moment where you said, all right, I'm still here.
Mm-hmm.
There's still something inside of me. My dreams have not died. What do you physically do next? This is the part of the story I always want to ask people because people then say, and so I got it together. What did you do? How do you get out of that space?
Well, the first part was there was this moment where I realized I'm not the only one screwed up. We're all screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
There's this piece of us as life force, as human beings that are trying to really navigate the landscape and figure out where we belong and where we fit in a place for us to call home, you know. And we talk about homelessness and those unfortunate realities, but many of us are experiencing spiritual displacement. And
speak to that. What's spiritual displacement?
Spiritual displacement meaning you can have all the outside trappings. You can have that job. You can have that relationship. You can have that bank account balance or whatever these things are that society tells us makes us symbols of success,
mm-hmm.
and then still feel completely bankrupt,
mm-hmm.
spiritually. So feeling like I can't even sit within my own skin, feeling like you need some kind of, you know, drink or drug or some kind of materialistic reward or something to make yourself feel
mm-hmm.
that you're okay. And I feel that's a human experience. And I feel that because I have a level of awareness and honesty and truth that many people take years to connect with, I felt I didn't really need the drugs
mm-hmm.
or any of that to navigate that space. Like, going back to Kentucky, I knew there were other people like me, you know, other trans people. Now we're in a place where, like, I broadened that that idea and realized everybody at some point in their life has to feel like me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's completely independent of their race, their gender, their, you know, orientation, all of that. So I knew that, I mean, I couldn't do much if I was, like, heavily under the influence and kind of, like, trying to kind of escape and numb myself. So I discontinued drugs, which was really, really difficult because most people have a vice. Like, it's just like it's a human thing. But right. to not drink, to not use drugs, to be more fiscally responsible, because of survival sex work, like, there's a lot of impairment with my love life and sex life and how I relate to people. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's almost like you're going through puberty all over, like adolescence. Like, I'm learning how to do things in a different way.
Yeah.
All over again.
And that's, in some ways, the journey of life. I noticed that there's seasons. Mm-hmm. And at the end of every season, I have to learn how to do something that I've always done differently. Mm-hmm. Think differently, feel differently, engage with other people, dream differently. Like that is part of the growing process, right? Mm-hmm. But it's painful sometimes.
Oh my gosh.
It's painful.
So painful that you somewhat build a tolerance. In fact, people say it all the time, like, how in the world do you do all of this? Every time I see you, not only are you on the go, but you're doing some pretty major things. And it's almost like you build up this tolerance mm-hmm. to pain and trauma and turmoil. And everything that I've been through has prepared me for these moments that I find myself in today and for the moments that are to come. Because things just aren't getting better. We're going backwards, you know? And so I kind of, you know, you see those movies where there's these, like, superheroes and they're kind of going through their process and their little boot camps, or they discover those powers and they're playing with them, testing them out, trying to figure. I'm like my own...
You're a superwoman.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just call it what it is. You're a superwoman. Yeah.
And even that, you know, we're taught that we can't say those things about ourselves. Mm. We're taught that we can't be proud of our strength and our courage and our tenacity and our resilience and all of those things that would make a man, you know, remarkable.
Yeah.
But as a woman, more specifically, as a Black woman, more specifically, as a Black trans woman, we're taught... You know, we're not enough without a man, or we're not enough without being able to use our sexuality as a weapon, or, you know.
I mean, the list goes on. Not enough if your hair doesn't look a certain way,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If it's not it's texture. If your actual coloring isn't a certain way.
Yeah.
Those messages are all around.
Yeah. And so to be able to say that, no, I'm actually enough. I actually am beautiful. I actually am intelligent. I am a leader. I am resilient and strong and all of those things. It's an act of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm getting to that place now where I think that my activism has evolved because I can look at myself and tell myself that in the mirror, and I don't need as much outside affirmation as I did before.
Mm. So then let me ask you this. You're Superwoman, right?
Uh-huh.
You are strong. You are beautiful. You are all of it. Are you ever afraid now that you've come into your own and your work is so bold? Mm-hmm. Do you have moments of quote-unquote weakness? Because I think part of the other pushback to the Superwoman narrative, mm-hmm. particularly when it comes to Black women and maybe also for Black trans women, right, is... Oh, you're impervious. You're so strong. You never cry. You never break. You're never weak. So when this pendulum swings the other direction, are you ever afraid? And if so, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with your moments of weakness?
I think my only fear is what happens when I'm no longer needed in the capacity that I'm needed in now, because in activism and in any major work that we do as a contribution to society at large, many of the people that are out here paving the way and leading were really terrible with self-care.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, so I keep hearing self-care come up. Self-care, what does that look like? What would that feel like? What does that mean for me? And again, many people, it's kind of funny, people think that self-care is something that's supposed to make us, like, healthier and stronger. But what I've seen in society is typically self-care are things that are actually the antithesis of care. Well, I mean, people like, I'm going to do some self-care. I'm going to go get smashed at the bar where, like, I can hardly stand up. Or I'm going to just, like, for me, like, food has been, like, a constant, like, battle most of my life. You mm-hmm. know, even eating disorders as a kid, all of that. So, you know, I can't have that kind of a relationship to food or else it'll become toxic.
Right.
You know, spending, you know, gambling, you know, all of these different, you know, vices.
Yep.
And typically when I hear people talk about self-care, I always see them attached to vices. And again, there's nothing wrong with that for most people, but because I'm an addict, like I have an addictive personality. So I don't have the dubious luxury of
doing some indulgences in that way. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So then what does self-care look like for you?
That's what I'm figuring out. Mm-hmm. And it's those moments when I take a second to breathe and I slow down and I'm like, okay, it's me and you. What do we do?
And to yourself.
To myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, I have no idea. Mm. And so my fear has always been someday when I've made the change that I seek to make and the youngsters have stepped in and and I've already like put that succession plan into play and I'm mm-hmm. stepping back, really not knowing where to go from there.
What to do after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I was working at a national civil rights organization and there was kind of, and we were a coalition of organizations and there was this unspoken generational tension and battle going on, right? And I was like 23 at the time. And my elders who I worked with and for, I'm talking about the head of the NAACP and all these organizations, they were like in their 50s and 60s. And my peers and I felt as if, gosh, y'all just won't move over, right? Y'all just leave the table and let us, you know, take over, listen to our ideas, let us assume leadership. And so we were having this conference where we finally decided to kind of bring this issue to the table, to the forefront, and say, look, what's going on? And I'll never forget this. One of my elders said, you know what? We do respect you all. We appreciate what you bring. But have you ever thought that for us, for those of us who are leaders in the movement, we don't have any place to go? We don't have 401ks. You know, we didn't have retirement accounts for protesting in the streets. Our organizations don't have these luxurious boards that can pay us for the rest of our lives. He said, so part of the next step of the movement is figuring out what do we do, you know? And so I thought about that. So it always strikes me as important when we talk about people moving over and moving on and passing batons. Like, I think it's incumbent upon us to also think about what do we do with our elders when they move on, you mm-hmm. know? So it's good that you're thinking about that for your own self now, because we all have that question.
Yeah. And I've actually been faced with it within the transgender community. So Caitlyn Jenner. So that.
See, I haven't even mentioned her name yet.
Yeah.
Go. Good. Let's bring it up. Oh, I think so, I did mention it once, but I didn't stay there. So go ahead.
So, you know, many people know that I've said it over and over that I believe Caitlyn Jenner to be the Christopher Columbus of trans identity. Ooh. Like, she has sailed over into the community that we've already been working this movement for years and decades and generations. But the media and Hollywood continues to deem her as this trans media trailblazer, mm-hmm. which further propagates anti-blackness because you have people like Laverne Cox and people like Janet Mock, who I adore Janet Mock, and Jasmine Creighton, and all of these amazing people that have paved the way a long time ago. And so what I noticed, especially after November 8th, after she continue to support an administration that has aimed legislation at our head since day one. Mm-hmm. They have attacked trans children, service members, anything they could do to kind of drive, I can't even say a religious agenda, because it's not from a religious place. It's from a hateful place.
It's hate
rebranded, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that someone could support that type of administration, which is the complete opposite of everything that we stand for and the things that we're trying to fight for as the LGBTQ+ community, is problematic. And when she did come around, what I felt, and many of us feel, is that we're being used as social experiments. As an extension to the Kardashian brand, as kind of like this press opportunity, and the pain and trauma and experiences that we've had are so real mm-hmm. that you don't get to come in and make us puppets to your propaganda. Mm-hmm. Not here for it. Mm-hmm. What I recognized, and I'm going to tie this back into what we were talking about with those who came before us and our elders and the way that they advocated and the way that they showed up, we get some wins along the way, right? Mm-hmm. But what happens is once we get those wins, sometimes we're okay with those and we become complacent and progress is halted. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a problem for the generation that has to live with the atrocities and the egregious things that are happening, because although it wasn't as bad as maybe when you were younger and when you began your work and your advocacy, it's bad enough for our 13-year-olds and 12-year-olds to commit suicide. It's bad enough for them to be bullied and raped at school and all types of terrible, 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 terrible things that happen. Mm-hmm. And so this is where, for me, I felt that it was important to speak up about the fact that we're letting somebody come in with $100 million and undo everything that we've worked for the last several generations. Mm-hmm. And we're giving her a pass and we're making exceptions. And so what happened in that moment was there were many people that felt empowered and they felt heard and they felt seen for the first time.
So, in what moment? In the moment where you spoke out?
Yes, in the where I actually challenged her
directly
because I actually, see, there was another piece there. I knew Caitlyn Jenner before that.
Ooh, you give me the tea now.
And
I didn't know that.
And many people, because she tried it in that video when she was like, you don't know me? And I'm like, mama, don't try it, sis. Please don't try my nerve. Caitlyn would always come to all the fundraisers. I met Caitlyn at a fundraiser for CHLA when I was Miss Quest 2016 through APAIT. And it was just a casual, like everybody was like fangirling over her. And I was just kind of in the corner, you know.
Unimpressed.
Catching. Yeah. It was like, okay, she's Caitlyn Jenner. We get it. Move along, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because the crowd had kind of pushed her back toward me. And I was going to move, but then her security was like, no, can you stay there? Because, like, you're actually helping us, like, block all of that. And obviously, like, I wasn't impressed. And then she turned around and was like, so what is your story? And I was just like, well, obviously, I'm not just here wearing a crown because it's fun and it's Sunday. Like, I'm here because I'm Miss Quest. And we were talking. And then from there, I would see her like in different spaces and we started trying to do the work together. At that time, many people had a problem with her because she was a Republican. But for me, I don't know. I've always, again, pushing boundaries. I've always had the capacity to see people at face value. So that wasn't like a deal breaker for me. First of all, you don't even know who you are. You have assume the identity and life of someone else for the last 60-something years. Mm-hmm. So the same way your gender expression is evolving, who's to say that your political beliefs and ideology can't evolve with you?
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I wanted to give her that space without judging her, without critiquing her. And what happened was that November 8th, anybody that hasn't changed after November 8th, there's something wrong.
I was going to say, everybody, no matter where you were.
Yeah.
It
like,
changed.
Even like my own activism, like, I was never, like, I played by respectability politics. I would never.
Who did? You did?
Me, oh my gosh. Like, I would kind
this
of.
This is news to me.
Yeah. I was not. You can actually go back and look at my work. I was never as, like, in your face, mm-hmm. which is why Tommy Lahren, Charlemagne the God, Scotty Nell Hughes, all of these people that I've came, TMZ, like, I dragged TMZ, you know, that was after November 8th.
So you hit a new level.
I hit a new level.
Yeah.
And then that's when I started being catapulted into mainstream and things like that. But I was really heartbroken and disappointed because I took some pushback from community for associating with her because they were like, yeah, but she's a Republican. And I'm like, yeah, but the thing is that we need to kind of create that room for growth.
So you had been open and willing,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Given the space.
Yes.
And then November 8th.
November 8th.
And then hearing her continued support of Trump.
Yes, trying to, well, he said I can use the bathroom in his hotel. Thanks, Donald. And it's like, This stuff is not a game.
I was going to say, stuff stopped being funny.
It's not a game. It's not a joke. It's not a game. And your cognitive dissonance is underwhelming.
Mm.
It's not a game. Mm. It's not a game. You know, the more that we continue to watch trans lives be snatched from us, and the more we continue to see black men killed in routine traffic stops, and we continue to see black women with their heads smashed in the pavement, and Charlene Lau, you know, shot down in a house with her kids, you know, just all of these things, all of these egregious, terrible, problematic things that continue to happen, it's not a game. If you do what you always did, you're going to get what you always got. And so after November 8th, that was the moment for many of us where we decided that we will not take any more. Every historical movement that shifted into something greater had that moment of clarity and that moment of realization that, you know what, it's all or nothing and we need all hands on deck. Mm-hmm. And so what happened with Caitlin was, and this is when it got interesting, I started to see the field slave and the house slave dynamic take on a whole new life again.
Okay. In what context?
In the context of the transgender community, right? Okay. Because essentially, our community is just a microcosm of everything that's happening on the outside and everything that's been happening. History always repeats itself, you know, because the children will never learn. You know what I mean? So they will never learn.
Right.
You know, whereas I didn't have as many problems with white trans women, all of a sudden, they felt empowered. You know, because now when Caitlin Christ, our Lord and Savior, came mm-hmm. and she lowered the bar, mm-hmm. and now you have these white trans women that had it not been for their transness, they would have had full access to male white privilege. But now that Caitlin brought that, you know, Caitlin Columbus sailed over and she brought all of those treasures and all of those things. Now they had a new leader. Mm-hmm. And anybody that didn't bow to Caitlin Christ, their Lord and Savior, they were going to have a problem with them. And so we started to see this divisiveness in the community. And unfortunately, there were people of color. You know, people get mad when I say this, but I'm very like, I say what I feel. They started cooning for Caitlin. And then it was, you know, yes, she goes against everything that we claim to stand for and work for in the nonprofit industrial complex. And yes, but she's not that bad. So the same folks that was coming for my edges when I was friends with her
are now saying,
whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, and even with that money, we're talking $25,000 to $50,000 max. That's tax shelter money. We're nothing more than tax shelter.
Mm. So what do you say to people? Because the common refrain I hear when I talk about or kind of shed light on intra-community conflicts, right? Mm-hmm. So within a movement, people mm-hmm. who have differences of opinion, differences of approach, the common response to that is, y'all, can't we all just get along?
Oh, my gosh, right? Yes. And that's in the same vein, even. They almost are in the same movement as the All Lives Matter people, where it's kind of just like, well, you know, can't we all just get along? What's with all this infighting? It ain't infighting if you were never in, darling. That was the problem. So when we're talking about this infighting, you know, what you're really saying is, why are you putting me in a position to have to defend my privilege? Why are you putting me in a position to where I have to recognize my privilege, see it for what it is, and check it? Because everybody's an ally until it's time to align with the objectives and mission of the most marginalized among us. Allyship is the new chihuahua in a handbag. So you had all of these white trans women that were talking about, oh, yes, we see black trans women and we all this, until our stories and experiences and challenges put you in an inconvenient position. And so we don't know how to sit in the uncomfortability of inconvenience. Mm-hmm. So what happened was that not only did they start challenging some of the black girls and the Latina girls and, you know, black and brown folks, but then you also have black and brown folk who assume the role of house slave, where they didn't mind taking the crumbs that fell from the table, and they didn't mind being complicit mm-hmm. and further reinforcing the oppression within their own community. And that's why I often use the term, you know, field slave, house slave dynamic, because when you look at that relationship even, that was the touchstone for divide and conquer. You give one part of that demographic a false sense of privilege over the other. You know, even back in slavery, when we're talking about like slave masters and nobody wants to talk about the fact that it was actually black house slaves that were whipping the flesh off of black backs. They were in charge of overseeing other black people. So there's this policing that goes on. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, with some of the older people that have been doing the work and the movement, they have kind of sold out to their own conscience. And they're not even aware of it because they're licking their plate clean at an all-you-can-eat buffet. They don't even realize there's more where that came from,
right,
and that they don't have to carry that by themselves. This is where those who they've done the work for get to step in and continue to carry the torch.
So I would imagine that having some of these opinions and using your voice in the way that you use it makes you unpopular in some circles.
Oh, of course. But I'm here for it. In fact, sometimes that's a part of my approach even. Like, I'm Petty Crocker. I'm always cooking it up. Always cooking it up. You know, because the thing is that as someone who had to experience childhood sexual abuse and incest and, you know, all of these terrible things that happened to me that should happen to no child, one of the biggest mistakes that we make in the black community in particular is that ideology that whatever happens at home stays at home. You don't go airing out your dirty laundry. When we say that, what we're doing is we're enforcing censorship. And we're talking about silence. And silence is toxic.
Yeah.
And it propagates rape culture and, you know, violence and racism and all of these terrible things that happen because, if we don't talk about it, maybe it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have generations of people that are broken and they can't find healing because we've been taught that silence will save us.
Mm-hmm.
And it absolutely will not. So the thing about me is that when you're actually doing the work, I already know that it's going to make people feel uncomfortable and they're not going to be here for it because I'm a light. And when you're a light and you walk into a room, you cause people to see themselves for the first time. And some of them aren't ready for it. And the thing is, we don't have the time to wait for them to get ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either you're with us and you're rolling, you're a quick study, or we keep going without you or over you. But at the end of the day, I will not personally prop up systems of oppression, even if they're operated by members of our own.
So let me ask you a question now. You're a light. You come into these spaces. You mm-hmm. show people, not just themselves, but you show people, to go back to our earlier point about reality, different realities, that different ways of being and living and operating in movement, not a movement, are possible.
Mm-hmm.
Who is your light? Who does that for you?
My mom. She's actually really annoying. Like, she calls me like several times a day, and she is so proud of her baby. And coming from a time when she didn't know if I was alive or dead out here because mm-hmm. of my fast life and everything that I was doing, and she would lose lots of sleep, her and my sister. And, you know, to be able to know that at the end of the day, despite who says what and how they say it, mm-hmm. that my mom was so proud of me. And mm-hmm. I know that not all of us have that story.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us are kicked out of our homes at an early age. Many of us have to experience anti-blackness. To me, transphobia toward a black trans woman is still another form of anti-blackness because I can't separate my gender from my race, from my any of that. Mm-hmm. So to know that at the end of the day, like, I'm blessed to still have my mother
mm-hmm.
and
who
loves me mm-hmm. and who's here for the pettiness. Like, she's here.
Is she?
Oh, my God. I've taught her how to use gifts and she knows all the lingo, shade. It is hilarious. Like, that's my safe place.
Mm-hmm.
And who better to affirm your path and your existence and your purpose and everything that you're doing than the person who gave you life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's powerful.
It's very powerful.
And so for me, like, that's who my light is. And I don't always get to say it as much as I would like to because, like, I'm busy running around taking on all these things. But
well, you know she's going to hear this.
Yeah. Yeah. She's nosy. Oh, my God. My mother, I was like, you know what? I need to get you on payroll because my mother does, like, she scans for Google SEO.
Every time.
She knows when articles run on me before I know.
I love mothers. I love them. You know? Okay. So then let me ask you this. So we know your mother is your light.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to be when you grow up now?
Sane.
Real. That is such a real answer.
Because there is so much going on, to tell you the truth. I have no idea how I'm still sane. Mm-hmm. I have absolutely no idea, like, what, for some reason, that flame, it hasn't flickered.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to come through everything that I'm coming through and to look back on all of the pain, the hardship, the challenges, the victories, the success, those moments of celebration, and say, you did that.
What do you want the world to look like when you get there?
I want to be able to see my babies now, my young people, like in their like late teens, you know, early 20s, be like, I'm doing this, 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 and seeing them running the show and seeing them carrying that torch. Because to be honest with you, this isn't a race. Mm. And there's no finish line. There's no graduation. There's no ceremony. We're talking about spiritual warfare. There's always going to be these forces. And the thing is that we win some and we lose some, you know? And so it looks like in my generation, in my lifetime even, I've never seen a time that is as tumultuous as it is now.
Right.
You know, and so I've been winning most of my life in comparison to, like, you know, what's happening now. And so I want them to be able to have the chance to reap the benefits of the work that I'm doing now, the way that I've reaped the benefits of the work that Dr. King and many other influential people did at that time, that they have the courage and strength. And also that I'm actually, people talk about doing the work and going unnoticed and, you know, not getting that pat on the back. And for me, that pat on the back looks like seeing them enjoy a better life.
I was just going to ask you, maybe that is the answer. Yeah. I was going to ask, so if we know it's not a race and there's no clear finish line, how do you measure your own success and impact on a daily basis? Like, you have to be able to, at some point, right, take your armor off, take the S off your chest, go to sleep and feel like, I did good today. How do you do that? What is that for you?
Well, I guess we're talking about tangible results. I measure it when I see other people's feedback and, like, the comments and messages in my inbox. And even when we talk about the ways in which we're dismantling different systems of oppression, I don't really know that I ever feel that it's completely done, but I'll rephrase it this way. I feel I'm following my life's purpose when I get heavy pushback, because people always want to talk about, you know, oh, I want to be a hero and this and, you know, like, this is what it means to be. But we always celebrate icons and people when they're dead and they're long gone. But when they're here, like Martin Luther King, he had a 28% approval rate at the time of his assassination because he was opposed to the Vietnam War.
Yep.
And he was talking about things with trade unions and, like, different, all of these unpopular things.
He wasn't on a stamp then, let's be clear.
No.
Right?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. And there were even, you know, Malcolm X and other, Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera. She was booed off of the stage at a celebration that she laid the foundation for, her and Marsha P. Johnson. That's the reality of it. And so it's almost, it reminds me of this age-old adage from Kentucky when they said, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Yeah.
So, like, everybody wants to be heroic and they want to be an icon and they want to be a leader, but nobody wants to go against the grain. No one wants to take the backlash or the pushback or the uncertainty and the fear of it. You know, there are things, you were talking about fear. My fear tolerance is, like, very, it's different because, like, I've overcome a lot and there's nothing that really scares me like that. I do have to be more mindful about, you know, posting where I'm at on social media. Also, I don't just bring anybody to my house. Like, I'm very careful because when you start messing with those who are wealthy and those problematic figures, it's usually like white supremacists. I'm up against white supremacy, the abuse of power and privilege. And historically, even if people do their homework, the U.S. government has murdered a lot of people.
I was just going to say, when you were struggling for the word, I was going to say, you mean the foundation of the way of our nation, right? These are the structures that have built everything that we see. So when you start to rattle that, pushback is a light word for what you're getting.
Yeah, especially now, because to be honest with you, what we're looking at is white supremacy on its deathbed.
I hope so.
Oh my gosh, look at who we have in office.
Yeah, it's like the
that
last
is hurrah. Payback for having a black man and his family in the White House. That is payback. And it's one of those things where it's so bad that we're starting to collude with like Russia, and it's white supremacy on its deathbed is not to be toyed with. It's so bad that it's eating its own young. I mean, look at Heather Heyer and like all of these like different, you know, the young woman that was killed in Virginia. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, look at things like that. Like, this is crucial because now you have other white people that are standing against white supremacy, and they're challenging that, and they're calling it out, and they're owning it, and they're rejecting it. And so they're losing their heirs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so when that happens, there's going to be, just like you said, pushback is not the word.
Right.
We're about to head into an all full-on war. And so it's also making sure that I'm intentional about self-care so that I'm recharged and I can continue to trudge. Mm-hmm. And it's also about being very strategic, especially the more I become mainstream, because, you know, there's been like hate mail and people have said things online or like made threats, or like at the end of the day, I believe that what I'm here to do is so powerful and so meaningful that nothing can stop me. What's for me is what's for me, and it's for all of us. And in the words of my auntie Maxine, who I've had the pleasure of linking up with and having a conversation with, I will not be intimidated. If they want it, they can have it.
And you're going to reclaim your time.
Yes, reclaiming my time.
Ashley Marie, thank you so much. Thank you for being an inspiration. Thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you for answering your call when you left Kentucky and decided, I'm going to go do something. I'm going to be something big and powerful in the world. Everyone is reaping the results of that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I told you she was a powerhouse. Hopefully she got you thinking about your own activism. I know she got me thinking about mine. Thanks so much to Ashley Marie for joining me. This episode was produced by Erica Morrison, published, of course, by Mam Repeller, and I'm your host, Eric William Simon. I love, love, love hearing from you, so make sure to hit me up. I'm on Instagram at Miss E. Will or on Twitter at Created by Erica. Tell me what you thought of this conversation and who else you want to hear on the show. In the meantime, until next week, you know what to do. Keep dreaming, keep doing, keep fighting, and above all, keep answering your call. Peace, y'all. Calling, 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 yeah. Calling, yeah.